Yeah, not just the people responding to it, but the business owners. Because if it's up to the business owners to make these decisions at the end of the day, are you going to have places that are more lax about the rules and others that are more... I mean, right now, you know, there is a difference between how Safeway is handling things versus New Seasons, right? So that's,
right.
That's also a discussion. And then is that another mirror onto society and what we are doing as people, individuals? It's all of these questions. Thank you so much for you know, spending this time and discussing this with me. Appreciate you, Althea. Thank you so much, Sonia.
Yeah, appreciate you.
And I think
right
it's
on.
Just about that time for us
it
to
is.
Wrap up. And thank you all so much. We'll be back next week.
And that was Mind the Gap, or Bridging the Gap, because girls are powerful. Those were my girls, Tammy and Althea. And this is your girl, Sonia, here, bringing you into the 9 o'clock hour at KBOO Portland, where coming up we have Veterans Voice with Marvin, with featuring a guest, Mr. Joe Lewis. We're going to get right to that in just a moment, so stay tuned. This is the Veteran's Voice featuring Marvin. Go ahead, Marvin.
Voice, which is Veteran Voice is one word. I'm Marvin, and Sonia is doing the engineering, and I appreciate it, Sonia, and I've known her for a long time. A good rock and roller just passed away not too long ago, Little Richard. You know, rock and roll, that he's the one that started a lot of this rock and roll, and man, You know, Tutti Frutti and all those songs. He's a wonderful singer. And also I want to say, before we get started in talking to Joe about Kent State, South China Sea, I keep telling folks about that, to keep an eye on that, because the U.S. and Britain has been sending a lot of more troops, I mean a lot of ships into that area now, and China is not backing down. And so it's been a whole build up to that. The U.S. has been doing all this propaganda, building up their lies about China and everything like that. So we really have to keep an eye, an eye on that. And boy, if that goes, that's going to be a pretty bad scene. And today we're going to talk to Joe Lewis. Joe was a student at Kent State, and on May 4, 1970, he, along with 9 other people, were wounded by the Ohio National Guard, and 4 very young students were killed by those same troops that fired into those students. And I'll have Joe say the names of those four young students. And also, we're going to talk a little bit about the 50th anniversary of the shootings at Kent State. And also, today is the 50th anniversary of the killings at Jackson State University, where 2 young African-American students were killed, and 12 were wounded, and they were shot and killed by the police. I know that the Mississippi Highway Patrol was it, and I think the city police is also involved in that, and we'll talk about that too. We don't want to forget our brothers and sisters from Jackson State that were killed. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, my friend. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. We've been texting back and forth all morning. Joe's a good friend of mine, and I've known him for, 20 some years now.
Yeah, I think 25 years or so.
Yeah, pretty. He, Joe, and Jim Russell, another was a student at Jackson State, and he was at Kent State, and he was also shot by the National Guard, and he passed away some years ago, and it was a big loss for Joe, I know, and for the rest of us that knew him. So, could you, Joe, go ahead and talk about the 4 young students that were killed that day?
I'll be glad to, Marvin. You know, that's the only reason I speak about the Kent State shooting. It's not like an accomplishment on my part, but I have to keep alive the memory of those 4 students who died that day, because I feel they would be speaking about me if the shoe was on the other foot, as it were.
I'm sure.
But before I mention our 4 Kent State students that were killed, like you pointed out, today is the 50th anniversary of the shooting and killing of Jackson State students, and I just want to say their names so that we never forget. James Earl Green and Philip Gibbs, who were shot at Jackson State in Mississippi when the police authorities there fired 150 rounds over 28 seconds, killing them and wounding a dozen others, and just really pockmarking the side of the building with bullet holes. It was a tragedy that happened and was needless. And every year at Kent State, we hold a commemoration for the May 4th shootings there, but we never fail to mention the Jackson State killings, where these 2 young people were killed too. And we had a great speaker who was a student there at the time, Gene Young, who used to come every year to Kent State and memorialize the Jackson State murders. And sadly, we've also lost Gene to time, and he's passed away. But I wanted to mention the the names and the distances from the guardsmen, who, you know, it's kind of something we hear too often. They were afraid for their lives, they said. But Jeff Miller, who was killed, was 265 feet away. Allison Krause was 343 feet away. Bill Schroeder was 382 feet away. And Sandy Scheuer was 390 feet away. So it's preposterous that, these four people posed any threat to the guardsmen on the hilltop that day with their gas masks and tear gas, M1 rifles, and fixed bayonets. People seem to forget there were fixed bayonets on the end of these high-powered rifles, too. And even myself, now I was the closest one shot to the guardsmen. I was 65 feet away, but I was motionless and silent, and I was very frustrated. I was a pretty naive, idealistic 18-year-old and very frustrated with being chased around my campus and told to disperse. Well, I was just a few yards from my dorm room, and they had come in from other places to assault us. And so I mistakenly gave them the finger when they aimed their rifles at me, and that was a mistake that almost proved fatal for me, and I don't recommend that practice. But I do think, you know, we have to remember our brothers at Jackson State. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, over the time, this has been a 50 years is a long time to go by, and we can't just look into the past. We have to examine our present, too. I mean, African Americans are still being killed in the streets of this country, and it's a problem. It was a problem then, and it continues to be a problem now, that we need to address justice in America. There's been no justice for the killings at Jackson State or Kent State, and frequently, even today, no justice for the murders that happen in our streets of African-American youth. And yeah, we just need to, first of all, pursue justice in these cases, but allow for a peaceful dissent when it occurs. And that's something that continues to be a problem around the country as we see these crackdowns from this current administration that seems to not allow anyone to speak who doesn't agree with them. And that's something we need to address, and we need to keep peaceful protest legal in this country.
Yes, we do, Joe.
There's been connections that I've made over the years because of the bad timing of my flipping off the guard at Kent State. I've managed to meet supporters. Both my family and my friends have kept me buoyed up and my spirits buoyed up through the discussion of these horrific events. But I'd just like to name off a few veterans, because the anti-war movement in the United States was a combination of efforts, not only from students, but especially from veterans and returning veterans and people like you, Marvin. And Laurel Browning, may she rest in peace, your partner in life, supported our voices and let them be heard throughout the Northwest here. But I also tick off a few other names of people who are important to me in this effort, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Don Blackburn, mm-hmm. These are the veterans who have been supportive. Mike Hasty, Bill Byers, Bud Brown, Brian Wilson, Frank Ryan, and the Congressional Medal of Honor winner who spoke with us all together at the Teach-In for Peace at Humboldt State University, Charlie Litke. And then we've also met there two Iraq veterans against the war, Tim Goodrich and Camille Mejia. And these people buoyed up you know, in the 50 years ago, the students at Kent State were blamed for the shootings. And so we had this burden of guilt as well as being assaulted and killed and paralyzed in Dean Kaler's case that can only be solved by people who understand where we're coming from. And the veterans like you and this group of friends that I mentioned, and others who I may have forgotten to mention, have joined with us in this effort to call out injustice in America. You know, no one's ever been held accountable for the shootings at Kent State or Jackson State, and there's an article in the May 4th New Yorker, and it says no one ever will, and that may be true, but it's a travesty that justice doesn't take place in these instances and many instances in our country today.
Joe, I want to ask you a question here, but I want to make a statement too, you know, that we feel, you know, us veterans, the guys you mentioned, you know, we've supported you and the other folks at Kent State and Jackson State because it was an injustice. It was an injustice what happened to you folks. And I was just been reading about all our African-American brothers and sisters that have been killed by the police.
Yeah.
And you made a very good statement about that, and that is a real problem, and we have it here in Portland too. And we can't let that go by without talking about it too. What I want to ask you, how far away was the young man McKenzie when he was shot? He wasn't killed, but he was shot.
Yeah, Scott McKenzie was, I think, 700 feet away. I have my book here. I can tell you exactly if I flip it open to the right page. He was 730 feet away.
Wow.
And he was walking away from the National Guardsman. An important other fact, you know, he was shot from behind, and the bullet went through the back of his neck and out his cheek. So he, like me, is very lucky to be alive. An important fact about the Kent State shooting, which I didn't realize until I read it some years later, was of the 13 people who were struck with bullets that day, 4 who died and 9 who were wounded, only Jeff Miller and I were facing the guard when we were shot. Everyone else was either lying on the ground like Dean Kaler and Bill Schroeder, or they were running away, or they were shot from the side. And so, you know, for them to say they were afraid for their lives from people who weren't even looking at them is ludicrous.
Yeah, yes it is. How far was our friend Jim Russell away?
Russell, he was at a completely different angle. He was slightly behind them. He was 375 feet away, struck by shotgun pellets in the temple and in the leg as he ran away.
Yeah,
they wheeled around with a shotgun to blast at him.
Yeah, because I was looking at the way the guard was set up. So, they had to turn. They had to turn to shoot Jim.
Yeah.
They had to.
Yeah, I really miss him. As you know, he and I did our Kent State presentations for years in colleges and high schools around the Northwest. And together, it was a very fluid storytelling that we both had different experiences and different points of view, but together it was very impactful, the story that we told as two people together, and I really sorely miss him. Jim was an amazing man. He was good at anything he did, and in 2007 he had a heart attack and died in his wife's arms in Deer Island, Oregon. And you know, that's just the way he would have planned it. He was an amazing man and a genius in many ways, and he saved my sanity during our 1975 trial, where the guardsmen were on one side of the courtroom laughing and joking because the way the judge was making rulings, they knew they were going to get away with murder. And the families of the students killed and some of us who were wounded were on the other side of the aisle. And I had moved to Scappoose a couple years before, so I was used to, you know, a very peaceful and quiet environment, and then thrown into this 14-week trial in the summer in Cleveland. And when we would leave the courtroom at lunchtime, the cameras and reporters would just swarm all around us, and And to tell you the truth, I was a little bit freaked out. I would not have handled it well if it hadn't been for Jim Russell, because he has so many varied interests. He could talk for hours about things that he knew a lot about, and so he would just talk to me, and we would walk through that line of reporters and camera people, and just go to lunch, and he would keep me from kind of losing it because he was so engaging and so interesting to talk with, and I really thank him for that, even to this day, keeping me sane in those hard times.
He was also older.
Yeah, he and I, you know, we had different points of view, because he was like a frat guy, and I was a pseudo-hippie for Ohio in those days, but I was the youngest person shot at 18, and he was the oldest person shot at 22, so a few years older, but at that age, it makes a bit of difference, not like
it
does.
Yeah, it does. It makes
now.
A big difference, and the guards got off.
Yeah, the guardsmen, there were 8 guardsmen who, according to our investigators, we suspect shot into the crowd, and they were never held accountable. In fact, the following fall, in October of 1970, the Portage County Grand Jury met and heard testimony, and they indicted 25 people, 24 students, and one professor. They didn't indict any guardsmen.
Were you one?
And this is another parallel to what happens to African Americans in this country. Myself, I was shot twice and then arrested. And so it just is an example of how the victims become the criminals in so many cases in the streets of America today.
Were you one of them that was indicted, right?
Yeah, I was arrested, for a misdemeanor of participating in a riot.
Oh my gosh, that is just so horrible. Hey, did you
know?
Oh,
it was unfair.
No, it was just unfair. I'm going to have you talk about that day, but I want to ask you, did you know that I think on the same day that students at Washington University burnt down their ROTC building?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
There had been a building burned at Kent a couple of days before, ROTC building.
Yeah, I just read that. I was looking through and I was reading about Jackson State, and they were mentioning how many universities just shut down, and they were talking about Washington's, it's in Missouri where it was, but yeah, it was in Missouri. And they were talking
about ROTC buildings were targeted all across America at that
sure
time.
Sure,
they were seen as an outpost of the military on college campuses. And for whatever reason, I mean, because of anti-war sentiment, they were targeted.
Yeah. So when was the ROTC building burnt, and how did that go about?
It was Saturday, May 2nd, 1970, and I was in my dorm at Johnson Hall, which is just across the commons from the ROTC building, and so I saw from just outside my dorm a group gather around the building and attempt to set it on fire, and there were several attempts that weren't really successful. Someone lit the drapes on fire and it went out, and someone threw a flare on the roof and it rolled off. And then someone in the crowd said, let's go around the campus to try to get more supporters. And so I followed along behind, and we went all around campus trying to gather more people to join our demonstration. And when we went around the front campus, you know, it's a pretty large campus, so this took a half an hour or so. And we got around to the front campus. That's when the Ohio National Guard came pulling into town. When I saw them for the first time with the jeeps and trucks and half tracks, actually. And so I hightailed it back towards my dorm. And when I got back to my dorm, the building was already burning pretty hard. And so I didn't actually see anyone light the building on fire. And so to me, it's always been really a suspicious circumstance of that night. Because while there were attempts to ignite the building, it didn't seem like they were successful until the student group was out of the area. And so to me, that's a bit suspicious. But
yeah.
So I got back to the dormitory, and I watched from my friend Tom Thompson's room. as the building went up in flames. And and coincidentally, while that was happening on the local or the Cleveland FM radio station, Buffalo Springfield, for what it's worth, was playing on the radio. And those two images will always be locked in my mind: the sight of that building burning and the sound of Buffalo Springfield playing, you know, "Something's Happening Here," but it isn't exactly clear. I never hear that song without thinking of that fire.
Yeah. So,
and so the National Guard then was bivouacked on our campus. 900 members of the Ohio National Guard were staying on the campus at Kent State. On the next day, Sunday, there was curfews in place on the campus and in the town. And the guardsmen were, I mean, they were somewhat friendly, especially with the co-eds. And people were talking. It was a sunny day. Spring in Ohio can be beautiful, and it was. And the guardsmen were talking with co-eds and everybody. And that's the day when Allison Krauss went up to a guardsman and put a flower in the barrel of his gun and said, "Flowers are better than bullets." Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if that was a true story till I heard her boyfriend, Barry Levine, tell it years later and describe how it happened and how he got in trouble with his commander, of course, for letting that happen. But she was killed the next day. But Sunday, it was like the war truly came home to Kent State when there were three helicopters overhead with searchlights, clouds of tear gas on the ground, and the guard was trying to enforce the curfew, so they were shoulder to shoulder sweeping the campus of any students who were out and about at bayonet point and chasing them back to their dormitories. And it was really horrifying. I had never been in a war zone or seen anything like that, and it was actually pretty terrifying to see the helicopters and searchlights overhead in the darkness playing on the crowd below, and people, you know, running and moving from place to place with the guardsmen close behind.
With fixed bayonets.
With fixed bayonets, oh yeah, shoulder to shoulder, fixed bayonets. And in fact, I had a conversation late that night in my dorm with my RA, my resident counselor, Lou Jeffries, because he had been trying to help students escape the guardsmen's bayonets by hustling them into one end of our building. You could go into one end of our dorm and pass through it to the other end and get out to a safer place in the quad. And so he was saying, "I don't care if you don't live here, just come in anyway and get out of harm's way." And as he told me the story that night, that as he ushered the last student in and pulled the door close behind him, the guardsman chasing them lunged with his bayonet so that his bayonet got jammed and got stuck in the door as he closed it on it.
Wow.
And this was terrifying. I mean, we talked about it later, and I said, you know, it's hard to tell who's right and who's wrong here, because the students were, you know, they were being a bit unruly, but the guardsmen were trying to assault them with the bayonets. In fact, several students were injured that night by bayonets.
Wow. So when did the, when was all the trouble downtown, Kent?
That was the Friday night. Now, remember, this whole incident, the whole long weekend began on Thursday, April 30th, when Nixon expanded the war in Vietnam by invading Cambodia. And so the following Friday, there was a demonstration on campus to bury the Constitution, because they said that Nixon had destroyed the Constitution. And that night, Friday, May 1st, that night in downtown Kent, there was some disruption down the bar scene. Kent was a very happening place in northeastern Ohio. There were 28 bars and 5 blocks with live music in a lot of them. And it was a great happening place. It was really a great scene for young people to go to. And so this was like the first nice Friday in that spring. So the bars were packed with people. And a few people started to demonstrate in the street, and someone lit a fire in a trash can and then pulled it out in the middle of the street and said, "It's a street party." And someone was racing their car up and down, and some of it was a protest related activity. But the mayor, very unwisely, at 11 o'clock that Friday night, decided to shut down all the bars. And to me, this is like throwing fuel on the fire, because now you have thousands, potentially, of students and other people being pushed out of the bars where they've been, you know, maybe drinking for a while. And so the streets kind of erupted in some violence, and some windows were broken, and the police were called out. And it's my understanding that the mayor had a conversation with the governor's office that night, who had a phone call into the vice president's office, and that's where I think my suspicions about federal involvement came in directly at that time, besides the attitude that the Nixon administration had, that student protesters were bums, according to President Nixon.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When everybody got back to the campus, and the National Guard was already there, right?
Well, the National Guard came in Saturday.
Okay, they came in Saturday. And
Saturday night,
sweeping through the campus.
Yeah, and Sunday night they were forbidding any. They had the curfew they were enforcing, so Sunday night they were sweeping the campus shoulder to shoulder at bayonet point, and students were fleeing to get out of harm's way under the searchlights of those helicopters.
And right, and I also go ahead, Joe.
There was a rally scheduled for Monday that, you know, I had heard about it, and I planned to attend to support the protest, the peaceful protest against the invasion and occupation of our campus by the Ohio National Guard. And so it was a very weird situation, because there were classes scheduled to happen as usual. The school was open. You know, and I'd saved my money all through high school to attend that year at Kent State. I was paying my own way, and working too during the weekends to pay for school. And so classes were open as usual. I felt like I should go, but there were these 900 guardsmen, you know, bivouacked on the campus, and they, at that morning, they were surrounding the ruins of the ROTC building with all their, you know, military gear. And they had ruled that they would not allow groups of four or more to gather on the campus. So classes as usual, no groups of four or more. I mean, it was impossible. It was an impossible situation, because when classes changed, you know, like every campus, throngs of students move from building to building. And the commons area where the ROTC building had been is like in the central part of that part of the campus. And so huge numbers of students were passing by, whether or not they were interested in participating in a demonstration or not. So it was an impossible situation, and it was like a bad policy move on the part of the National Guard and the administration of the university to allow that to happen.
Yeah. I heard
Go ahead, Marv.
Okay. I heard that at the Bell, when the Constitution was buried, that there were Vietnam vets there too.
Yeah, there were anti-war vets on the campus because, you know, a lot of the vets were taking advantage of the GI Bill.
Right.
So Kent State had quite a variety of students, you know, from the East Coast, from Ohio, young and old. You know, there were quite a few Vietnam vets there who were attending school, and a lot of young people who were, you know, pretty like me, wet behind the ears, and there were some people who were more politically astute than others. I mean, I was pretty naive and idealistic, but I had seen coverage, like every American, I had seen coverage of the war on our TVs, and seen veterans, you know, with gaping chest wounds, practically dying on Walter Cronkite on the 6 o'clock news. So I was adamantly opposed to the war in Vietnam, and didn't think it was the right thing to do. But as you know, my attitude has always been that while I hated the war, I defend the warriors and honor them. And I'm grateful to know, you know, veterans like you, who, you know, were served honorably defending our country, or not really defending our country, but served honorably in our services.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the day of the shootings. You know, you said something really interesting, and I said a lot too. You said those four students at Kent State and those two students at Jackson State were murdered.
Yeah.
And I agree with that 100%. The military and the police have this thing where they say they were killed.
Yeah.
You know, and that is, I didn't murder anybody. I killed somebody.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm with you. You know, they were murdered.
Yeah, so, they were murdered.
They were murdered. There's no doubt about it. Just like our African American brothers and sisters, they were murdered. On the day of the shootings, go ahead and talk about that day.
Well, you know, there was classes as usual, and so I thought I'd go to a class, and I went to a class with my friend, and it was a sociology class, and there were actually two different prevailing kind of attitudes that day that I heard. One was, you know, this is a participatory democracy, and if you want your voice heard, you need to participate and let people know where you stand on this day. The other one, though, was, look at these guys armed with these rifles. You better run and hide and stay out of harm's way. And so I took the first advice, and I thought, you know, that I would participate by lending my body, my presence, to the peaceful protesting against the occupation of our campus by the Ohio National Guard. And so I joined a crowd of 1,000 or so other students. As the so-called victory bell rang on the commons, I assembled with a lot of other students to protest the National Guard's presence. And we were standing peacefully on the hilltop. There were some chanting going on, some anti-war chants going on. People, you know, were just kind of milling around, watching and supporting each other by being there. And that was my point, too. You know, and the important thing, one important thing about the Kent State shootings was this happened in broad daylight, just after noon on Monday, May 4th, 1970, in front of Taylor Hall. And what Russell used to always say is, you can't have a cover up in front of the School of Journalism, because there were dozens of photographers out there, including many Kent State student photographers, journalism students. And so when I tell the story about May 4th, I always would, in our presentations, Russell and I would say, you don't have to believe us, because there's hundreds and hundreds of photographs of that day, and you can look at them and examine the demeanor of the students versus the demeanor of the guardsmen. And speaking for myself, I mean, I had on a pair of moccasins. I wasn't prepared to get into any kind of fight. And you know, there was some small gravel thrown, but no guardsmen were injured that day. And so I joined this group on the hilltop a little before noon, and at noon the bell rang, and the guardsmen were across the commons from us, a good 50 yards away, maybe more. And they were determined to break up the crowd. I guess that was their mission. And so they sent out a jeep that crossed the middle ground and came over by the group of students with a gentleman, a loudspeaker, who said, students of Kent State, this is an illegal assembly. Return to your dormitories. And he was met by catcalls and fingers and all kinds of gestures and hollering. And they did that three times, which I suppose is the requirement or something. Because in the third time, it just got more louder, and more people were like, you should get out of here, because we're here where we belong, and you're the people who are actually invading this space, and you need to go. And so when their announcement didn't result and everyone just leaving, they stepped forward, and about nine guys or so with tear gas launchers, and they were modified grenade launchers, fired tear gas across the open space into the group of students. And this is all photographically documented. But the wind was blowing the wrong way, so it wasn't really effective, and some students covered their mouths with wet hankies and ran up and grabbed the tear gas cylinders. They learned how to pick them up without getting burned and threw them back at the line of guardsmen. And even though this was very bizarre, it didn't seem imminently threatening. It was like a very bizarre give and take between the two groups, with cheers going up when the students would throw the canisters back, and boos when the guardsmen would fire another volley of tear gas. Eventually, that wasn't effective at dispersing the crowd either, so the guardsmen started to move bayonets at the ready towards the students and came crossing the field, marching in line, you know, towards the group of students. And so I was on the hillside between my dorm, Johnson Hall, and Taylor Hall, which were adjacent to each other. And so, like everyone else, I retreated and walked back up the hill between the buildings. And then I turned right in front of my dorm, Johnson Hall, and the guardsmen proceeded to come up the hill over the top and down the other side, crossing a little road and down into a place that was the practice football field. And so they got down to this practice football field, and it was kind of ironic because the field had a cyclone fence on two sides of it. To the far end of it, the far side of it from where they had entered, and to the right side of it was a cyclone fence enclosing the field. But when they got down there, they took out the bullhorn and again announced, "Students of Kent State, we have you surrounded." And what was ironic about that was the cyclone fence was on two sides of them. Then across the road and up on the hill overlooking them was a throng of 1,000 students. And so it was ludicrous because, you know, if anyone was surrounded, they were. I mean, it was very poorly planned and executed the whole time. And in fact, I have to say right now that if you need crowd control, you don't call in the Army. You know, you call in somebody who can do crowd control, not someone who's prepared to go to war. I mean, it's like we see nowadays in our cities, the militarization of police. You know, government and law enforcement are supposed to protect the people, not assault them. And so you don't come in like an occupying army to a city or to a campus. But if you need to have crowd control, you have people who are trained and equipped properly to do that work. And this was not the case at all at Kent State, and I hope that's something that's been learned since then, is a military response isn't appropriate when it comes to crowd control. And so they were down on this practice football field getting some catcalls and some harassment from the Prentice Hall parking lot area, which, as I looked down on them, was to the far left of the field. And their attention was drawn that way by the people who were hollering at them, as well as by my blood brother, Alan Canfora, who was holding a black flag up in front of them. And he was memorializing one of his high school classmates who had been killed in Vietnam about 10 days before. So he's holding this black flag, and there's one of the most powerful photos of that day is a group of about 10 guardsmen take a kneeling position and aim their M1 Garands in the direction of Alan and his black flag, as well as some other people in the Prentice Hall parking lot who were harassing them, who were very vocal. And so they held that position kneeling and aiming for a time. And then there was a meeting in the middle of the practice football field by, I assume, the commanders or someone. And then the guardsmen who were kneeling and aiming got up. They never fired, mind you, but they just gestured with their guns like that. Mm-hmm. And they got up and started to retrace their steps, at which point many of us thought it was over. They were leaving, going back the way they had come. Well, as they got up to retrace their steps and cross the little road, for service road, and go back up the hill the way they had come, they were marching directly at me, at my position, because I had moved to the right, then I drifted over to watch from the hilltop right in the center of the hill. And so they started to come back directly at my position, so immediately I moved to my left towards Taylor Hall to get out of the way, and not be very near to them to so they didn't feel like I was threatening them, because, I mean, they did have bayonets on their guns. And so I moved to the side, and they started marching back up the hill and hustling back up the hill, and I was, by dumb luck, I was very near to them, and I could hear their equipment jostling, and I could see that they were looking sharply over their right shoulders back to that Prentice Hall parking lot area. And in my mind, now that I reflect on it, I wonder, were they picking out targets, or what were they doing? Because that was the area where most of the people were killed. And they came back up the hill, passing in front of me from my left to my right, climbing the hilltop. And when the first guardsman reached the top of the hill and the corner of the railing in front of Taylor Hall, as I watched them, they got up there, and either by previous agreement, but we know now by a recorded tape recording that's been analyzed, there was an order given to fire. So they stopped, turned, and aimed, and when they aimed at me, I very foolishly, I have to say, I was motionless and silent and 65 feet away, standing still. They aimed their rifles at me. I gave them the finger. I was very frustrated with the activity and being chased around on my campus that I had paid so long to attend. And I didn't think the guns were loaded. I didn't think there was any reason for the guns to be loaded. I mean, it wasn't a active shooter situation or anything like that. And so I gave them the finger, they aimed their guns at me, and I started hearing these sounds, and I saw the ground in front of me poof up a couple of poofs of dirt, and that was the first time I realized that they had live ammunition in these guns, which, I mean, I wasn't raised in a gun culture. I wasn't, you know, as scared as I should have been. At the same moment, I was shot, and a bullet entered my abdomen just right of my right, just inside of my right hip, and knocked me to the ground. And I fell to the ground. And there was 13 seconds of gunfire. And I laid there, and when the gunfire stopped, there was just like a beat of dead silence before people realized what had happened, and there was all hell broke loose, all the screaming and stuff. And of course, I was laying on the ground, and the guardsmen withdrew. I didn't see them. I was down there, but the guardsmen withdrew, and students came up to me. A male student came up to me from my left, and I asked him, I couldn't get up, I couldn't sit up, and I asked him, how bad is it? And he saw the exit wound on my left hip. The entry wound's about the size of a quarter. Having shared the experience of being shot, you know, the entry wound was small. Mm-hmm. But even though these were steel jacketed rounds, so lucky for me, so it didn't tumble, but it hit my iliac bone, and the exit wound was the size of a Coke can. The entry wound the size of a quarter, and the exit wound the size of a Coke can by my hip. And I asked the student, how bad is it? And he said, he lied to me. I mean, he didn't know. He said, I think it's just a flesh wound. And I took some comfort in that, even though it wasn't true. I learned later in courtroom testimony that after I had been shot by that guy in the abdomen, a second person shot me, and it went through the bone, between the bones of my lower left leg, and I had already been shot. And so in our courtroom testimony, our lawyers asked this person, so if he had been shot already, why did you shoot him too? And these guardsmen in that trial, they knew they're going to get away with it. So he was very flippant. He said, well, everybody else was shooting him like that, and that was, you know, his excuse for attempted murder. Our lawyers were flabbergasted by this answer. Well, so I laid there, and a girl came up from my right and held my hand, and I squeezed that poor girl's hand for the whole time, and she stayed with me until the ambulances came, and I got loaded into an ambulance, and I was with another person who was shot behind me. It was John Cleary, and yeah, he was shot in the lungs, and he was in horrible pain. And so on our way to the hospital, it was just nightmarish. The person with us didn't know how to work the oxygen. I was having trouble breathing, and so was John. And he was really in pain. And And we got to Robbins Memorial Hospital, like 10 miles away in Ravenna. And the last thing I remember, and you and I have had this, we talked about it in our text this morning, the effect of shock on your protecting your body and your mind, because I was in shock. I didn't really feel the pain, and I didn't lose consciousness until we got all the way to the hospital. And the last thing I remember, and I always say it this way because it, to me it's weirdly funny, is the orderly said, "We're going to have to cut off your clothes." And I remember thinking, "Mom's not going to like that." And that was the last thing I remember, as I went into surgery for 6 hours and you know, got 6 pints of blood and fought for my life the next couple of days.
Yeah.
But I am very lucky. I know I'm very lucky because the four students who were killed were many times farther away than I am. I feel a bit of guilt about that. And my friend Dean Kaler, you know, he was born in a hunting culture. He knew about guns. When he heard that gunfire, he dove down on the ground. He was face down in the dirt when a bullet lodged next to his spine and paralyzed him for life. He is still a positive person and one of the most amazing people I've met. He and I, we and others, we realize that it's in our own personal selfish best interests to forgive the men who shot us. And it also goes along with my principles of, you know, forgive those who trespass against you. And so I've forgiven the two men who shot me a long time ago. I won't forget, but I have forgiven them. But what I always say is, I can't forgive them if they were responsible for killing those four 19 and 20-year-old kids that day, because that's not in my power to forgive them for that.
Right.
They'll have to answer to that eventually.
Yeah, that was just... When you were in the hospital, how many, besides the guy that was in the ambulance with you, how many were in that hospital with you of the nine that got shot?
I don't actually know exactly, but I do know that I was in intensive care with Dean Kaler on my right and John Cleary on my left. I know the three of us were in intensive care together. And the other guys who were shot, you know, some of them went to different hospitals, but some of them were there too. You know, we did not know each other before it happened.
Right.
The only person I had even the slightest acquaintance with was Allison Krause's boyfriend was my mailbox partner in the dorm. And so I would see her frequently during the week when they would be walking around campus together. And I always say she was attractive in every way, very vivacious. She was very politically engaged, and she attended, like I did, the October and November 1969 moratoriums against the war. But other than that mild acquaintance, I didn't know any of the other people who were associated with it. Although, you know, it's important to point out that everyone who was shot, because at the time the media was so manipulated, it talked about outside agitators and all this crap.
Yeah.
But the people who were shot, every single one of them was a student in good standing at Kent State that day.
I know. It was just unbelievable. My cousin, Bill, he was a combat medic in Vietnam, and we've talked about it. He said that when they found out over there about what happened, they were angry. They were angry that the students would be shot. And Bill said that they had a lot of conversations about it. You know, he was a medic, and, you know, he's patching guys up, you know. So he knows what was going on. And Bill said they weren't very happy at all.
Yeah, I've talked to quite a few veterans who had the same response.
Yeah, it's horrible. I can't... Let me ask you another question about this. I know, Jim, I remember the first time we interviewed you at the station, we were waiting to get ready to go back into the room, and we were talking, me and Jim were talking about wounds and everything, and he says, "Here, let me show you," and he pulled his pants down to show me a wound.
Well, yeah,
that's the kind of guy he was, you know.
Yeah, Jim, he was a really talented guy. He was really straightforward.
He was,
I really
definitely
miss him to this day.
Guy.
He passed away in 2007 while I was visiting my sons in Australia, and I was just having a heartbroken and alone feeling.
Yeah, That had to be. And then when we had the memorial there in Portland, boy, there's a lot of people there.
Yes.
A lot of people.
Had a lot of folks there, and some of our brothers from Ohio came in New York.
Yeah.
Tom Grace and Alan Canfora came, and Laurel came and talked about her experiences in Santa Barbara. And it was really touching and moving. And I'm still missing to this day, just thinking about that.
Yeah. And when we had the memorial at Jim's house, you know, that was really, really touching too.
Yeah.
Because all the people from that area out there, you know, I knew quite a few of them, and then meeting some of the folks from Kent State, that was just amazing.
Yeah, that was very powerful and touching. And my friends who are musicians played Ohio. It was very
Yeah, it was really interesting, and people.
Yeah,
that was a
group of a very touching moment and tribute to Jim and his and the breadth of his effect on people. It was far and wide. He had an effect on everyone he met.
Yeah, sure did. How many operations have you had from where you were shot?
Well, I can't make a direct medical connection to it, but my wound is about 4 inches inside my right hip, and for whatever reason, if that's the cause or not, I've had my right hip replaced 3 times now. So I don't know that it's directly connected, but I suspect that there's some kind of connection there.
Yeah. How about your ankle area?
My ankle I haven't had operated on. In fact, my other ankle I broke in a car wreck, so my shot ankle is actually my good ankle.
You know, that's funny.
I know. And there's a whole lot to be cheerful and laugh about in our mutual stories. You know.
You know, I had it all planned out. You know, to go back to Kent State. You know, you and I had talked about it, and I said, I'm going to try and go and everything. And I was just going to surprise you and your wife there, you know. And then
I would love to have you there. You know,
it was hard not to be there. Broke my heart.
It was really
I had
different.
My room and everything. Had my room and the rental car and everything.
Oh,
you know?
Man, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I would have been. I was going to
show up
around there, Marvin. We'll have to do it next year.
Yeah, maybe.
We
can. Yeah, so. Joey, we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you, buddy, for coming on and talking about this for the 50th anniversary. And give my best to your wife, okay?
I will, Marvin. And I just want to call out one more time the memory of James Earl Green and Philip Gibbs, who lost their lives 50 years ago today at Jackson State. Yeah.
Thanks, Joe. And we'll talk to you later, buddy.
Marvin.
Bye.
See ya. Bye.
That was Joe Lewis, one of the 9 students that was shot at Kent State, and talking about our friend Jim Russell, who was also shot that day, and the 4 students at Kent State and the 2 students at Jackson State that were murdered. And we'll be back on June 19th at 9 a.m., and there it is. And thank you, Tanya.
The sky is clearing and the night is bright. The sun, he come, the world is all up. Rejoice, rejoice, we have no choice.
is coming. Love is coming to us all.